My name is Mitch Schmanowitz. I went to JRB. How many of you are participating in the JRB?
Oh, okay. That's good. Hi. Perfect time.
And this, you're all in the right room because they did a switch on us this morning. We're supposed to be in.
Bordeaux,
and then we're in this room. Okay, so let's get started. Today's goals. That's my outline.
We can talk about just a quick update on the JRB today, which I did yesterday. We talked about percentage allowance in retirement. Anybody like that? Okay. We'll talk about saving for retirement. We'll talk about developing a strategy, and we'll talk about how the JRB options are available to help you meet that strategy. Okay? Sound good? Questions?
Do you mind if I tape this for sound?
No, that's I think we are being taped, but you're welcome to.
My husband's my money manager.
Oh. Okay. So we have almost 2,800 participants in the JRB plan today. Okay? The JRB is the plan for the denomination. We are available to both clergy and non-clergy. You have to be either a member of the Rabbinical Assembly, the member of the Cantor's Assembly, work for a congregation of the conservative movement in any capacity, as an executive director, as a secretary, as an accountant, as a custodian. You don't have to be Jewish. You know, what's the old saying, not to be Jewish to love Levi's Reverend? You don't have to be Jewish to be in the JRB. You just have to work for an organization or a congregation of the conservative movement. So, you know, all of the United Synagogue folks are in our plan. The JTS is in our plan, Women's League. So it's not just, but you have to have an affiliation with the conservative movement. So
a teacher at a Hebrew school qualifies.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
And member of the synagogue? No.
Members, no. Sorry. You have to get a paycheck from a conservative congregation because the contributions come out of your paycheck. Good question. Of our plan, we've got about 1,100 rabbis, 300 cantors. We manage over 600, well, we're closer to 665 today, but as of the end of December, we had 657 million. About two-thirds of that, 434 million, is held by rabbis. We take in contributions. So we had $21 million pass through my office last year of contributions for 1,500 active participants. 12 million of that, or 600 participants, came from rabbis. We are a benefits plan. That's what our goal is, to pay you your retirement benefits, okay? Last year we paid out $16 million in retirement benefits to 677 retirees. $10 million of that went to rabbis, mostly as a parsonage tax-free allowance. That's $10 million, which Uncle Sam didn't collect any tax on. Okay, very nice. 285 retired rabbis, and about 1.6 million went to surviving spouses of rabbis or cantors or other participants in the plan who left their money. So that's where we are today. I always like to show. Whoops. Yeah, I always like to show this just to give you a sense of who's representing you. The JRB, as I said, our board is made up of the major arms of the movement, the JTS, the Rabbinical Assembly, United Synagogue, the Cantor's Assembly, and we have two observers. So if you see the numbers, three out of four, so there are 13 trustees and two non-voting members, one from JEA, one from NAVASET. Are you familiar with those organizations?
Of course.
But if you look at the numbers, those are synagogue executives, right? So if you look at the numbers, of the 13 trustees, 7 are rabbis. So the rabbis always win, is what I say. Anytime there's an issue. Okay. But, you know, thank these people. Rabbi, you know, Gilly Dror, Felipe, Rabbi Greenbaum, Phyllis Hoffman. A lot of people know Phyllis knows the whole movement. Rabbi Arnold Marins, Rabbi Joel Myers is the vice chair, of course, Julie. Rabbi Matthew Simon has been a member for over 40 years of volunteer service. The United Synagogue has four representatives. Scott Kaplan is currently our chair. He is the general counsel for the United Synagogue. Gary Rosenthal is a former treasurer. Bob Shapiro runs their insurance committee. So we're well stocked. Cousin Abe Lubin, anybody know Cousin Lubin in the Baltimore area?
He represents
the Cantor's. Okay, that was the JRB today. Next issue, parsonage allowance and retirement. That's why we exist, okay, especially for you guys. There is a special ruling that the IRS made in 1975 called 7522, and it says that if a denomination has a benefits board of a board of trustees that represents the denomination, that that board can designate that payments made to retired clergy can be used for a housing allowance. Okay? Get all that? That's what we are. Okay, we follow those rules. Our board of directors, who you just saw, meets the definition of this benefits board, and therefore every year at the last board meeting in December, our trustees pass a resolution that says up to 100% of the money that's withdrawn by a retired rabbi can be used for parsonage. Okay, that makes us kosher. We have a letter from the IRS certification that makes us really kosher, that says that we are the denominational retirement plan for the conservative movement. That gives us the power and authority to give you a parsonage allowance in retirement.
Question. And is that category independent of the reality of whether the retired rabbi is actually paying for housing, meaning that the home has been completely paid off?
We have to justify the expenses. That's clear.
Yeah, of course. The same rules apply. We'll get to that in a second.
But if we didn't have a parsonage in here wrapping it because you worked for some organization that wouldn't allow parsonage, but you contributed to the JRB, you can get it in retirement. You worked for the American Jewish Committee, which won't allow parsonage.
Right. That's the answer is if you get parsonage from your employer, you can get parsonage through the JRB. Okay. But always see me for special situations. Okay, those are general rules. We have different. Okay, so. Here's an example of how parsonage and retirement works. Distribution to a retired clergy are exempt from federal income tax and Social Security taxes to the extent of the parsonage allowance. Again, the rules of determining the parsonage allowance, as you pointed out, are the same. Generally, it's the lesser of three values, or the least of three values. Number one, you look at your actual expenditures, and your actual expenditures are not only your mortgage payments, but your property taxes, utilities, homeowners insurance, what else? Lawn care, furniture purchases, appliance purchases, repairs, maintenance. You know, boiler breaks, you gotta get a new boiler. The roof leaks, you gotta repair the roof. Okay, all of those expenses that are attributable to maintaining a home. If you live in a condo association dues, etc., etc. If you've lived in a parsonage, meaning that you lived in a home that the congregation owned, and now you're buying a home, part of the down payment can be used for a parsonage allowance. Okay, so very, very liberal. It just has to have some relationship to, you know, your home. Not food, not entertainment, So here's the example. Let's say a retired rabbi withdrew $60,000 and they filed the notice with us that their parsonage allowance is going to be $50,000. Your taxable income is $10,000. So the first $50,000 is tax-free. The other $10,000 is subject to taxation. Did everybody know that? Okay. That's how it works. So everybody that's why we exist. Okay. If not, we would tell you to go invest your money with Vanguard or T. Rowe Price or Fidelity or Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley. None of those investment houses, when they pay you the money, can grant you a parsonage allowance because they're not a benefits board recognized by the IRS. We are. That's the big difference. Everybody get that? Okay. Now, here's a good point to note that when you claim a parsonage allowance when you're actively employed, although you don't pay income tax on that value, okay, you are subject to SECA tax. You're supposed to pay self-employment tax. However, in retirement, you do not have to pay Social Security taxes on the withdrawals that go to your parsonage. Okay, so is this the greatest thing? Okay, so not only, you know, self-employment taxes are 15%, so not only are you saving income tax, but you're saving Social Security taxes as well.
That again applies to us now, yes?
Yes. Now you have to pay Social Security tax as an actively employed clergy
on the parsonage,
amount, correct.
Interest. Okay. And so what you're saying is that even when you pass retirement age, if you're still employed and working, then you'll pay these taxes.
Right. Unless you take money out of the JRB. But if you're working, you don't need to take money out of the JRB because you're getting your parsonage from your congregation.
our retirement age is designated as 59 and a half. That's under the tax law. We have rabbis.
It might be a half. You might work 25 hours a week.
True. Well, you know, call us with every situation. My answer is the day you stop receiving a parsonage allowance from a congregation or an employer is when you look to the JRB, okay? Because you should start taking this money out. It's tax-free to you, okay? Only to you, because God forbid if you pass away, the beneficiaries would be subject to taxation, okay? So use it. And of course, even in retirement, you can still take a deduction for your property taxes and mortgage interest, okay? We call that double dipping. That still exists in the tax code. So if you look at books on financial planning, they always tell you that you should try to have your house paid off by the time of your retirement. And for non-clergy, that's a great idea for, you know, a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, the mortgage interest deduction is more valuable when you're working because you have a higher income and you can have a higher deduction on your taxes. And number two, you're making more money and you can afford to pay off the mortgage. But retirement means you're not earning a salary in general. So most financial planners say you should pay off your home. However, for clergy, that's not necessarily the case because you can still claim mortgage interest deductions in retirement on your mortgage. Okay, everybody get that? Now, I'm not saying you should retire and encumber yourself with $2 million of mortgage debt. I'm just saying if you have a choice of making extra payments to your mortgage, don't make the extra payments, but rather make additional contributions to your JRB account. Because number one, that's going to lower your taxes now. And number two, you're going to be able to withdraw that tax-free in the future. Okay? Concepts. Questions? Oh, sure. Okay. All right. So let's talk about saving for retirement. But again, everything is geared towards the parsonage. So now... Well, as we've got a mixture group, the one thing that we're seeing is the millennials are not doing a good job of saving, okay? And so we were trying to gear this to you guys, but as I said, we're open to everybody. So, you know, we did some studies. There was a big paper published by Tiercraft about millennials. They're young, they're highly educated, they're economically active. That's defined as they own checking. Like 98% of millennials have a checking or savings account. Phenomenal. They're into real estate, they have investments. But they have high debt levels, okay? They're swamped with saturated with college loans. They use their credit cards excessively. Yeah, I'm getting a couple of nods from millennials here.
The college loan card.
They're called financially fragile. Financially fragile means, as a general financial planning principle, you should have at least 3 months of an emergency fund set up. Okay. That's considered, I prefer 6 months, but at least 3 months, okay? And so most millennials don't even have enough to 3 months. God forbid if you lose your job or you're injured, you need 3 months to pay your rent, to buy groceries, etc.
Not if you have a disability insurance.
Pardon me?
Well, if you have disability insurance, you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, but millennials don't carry insurance. They don't have health insurance, they don't have disability insurance.
Right.
That's the problem. They don't have retirement insurance. They're millennials.
Yeah.
The problem is they don't think they're financially literate, okay? They don't think they know everything. But when a test was administered, 5 easy questions about finance and saving, only 14% answered all 5 financial questions, you know, correctly, and about, you know, 1/3 only had 3 to 5 correct. So they think they're financially literate.
What kind of questions were they asked? I'm very curious.
Well, I do have the study, so they're I will bring them up to you. But here's the problem here, you know, they have conflicting goals. They got to pay off their college loans, they got to buy a home, they got to pay for day school, our rabbis for their children, they need to save for their college education, and they need to save for retirement. So, you know, my focus is on saving for retirement, but I realize that you have these other competing financial goals that you have to satisfy. So let's focus on retirement. You know, some of you are closer than others, but when you do retire, we call this the three-legged stool. Did you get a copy of the presentation? No.
Melissa,
sorry. Oh, I put some copies.
Yeah, those we passed them out.
Oh.
Melissa, I'm retired already. Here you go.
take up the notes. I see you taking notes. So
it's just me.
No, that's fine. You can take notes on here. So, we call it the three-legged stool, okay? Social Security is one leg. The JRB Retirement Savings Plan or Pension Plan is your second leg. Your personal savings outside the JRB are considered your third leg. So let's focus on Social Security. If you were at my lunch talk yesterday, you can't answer this question. But does anybody know what the average Social Security benefit is today? The average benefit today is $15,000. Okay.
A year.
A year. Great. Okay. Raise your hand if you think you can live on $15,000 a year. Okay. Rabbis tend to make more. Okay. So your Social Security payments will likely be closer to $20,000, maybe $22,000. But again, raise your hand if you think you can live on $22,000 a year. Okay. And of course, millennials have the other issue to worry about: will Social Security be there? Okay, so it will provide something, hopefully, but if not, a lot. So don't bank on Social Security. Number two is your JRB savings account. That's the part that's going to give you your parsonage allowance. So you should plan to at least have enough money in your JRB retirement account to cover your parsonage allowance for the 20 to 30 years you'll spend in retirement. Okay, I used a quick example yesterday. If your parsonage allowance was $40,000 a year and you spend 25 years in retirement, that's $1 million. Okay, so what does that mean? That's $1 million in which you made contributions which lowered your taxable income at the time they were made. All the earnings grew tax-free, and then it's $1 million you get to withdraw each year for the 25, 30 years you'll spend in retirement. This is wonderful. Yes.
How do you know how much is your parsonage allowance? Everybody has a different one?
Everybody has a different one, yes.
And it depends on what?
Depends on, I pointed out, I have a little cheat sheet. It's your home expenses, your mortgage, your real estate, your expense, you know, up to the fair market rental value of the home. But see me afterwards if you have a question. I have a cheat sheet. And number three is your personal savings. I mean, you know, you need more than... You need more than you need more than housing in retirement. You know, you've got groceries, you've got entertainment, you've got travel to see the kids and the grandkids, etc., etc. So you need more. I mean, you know, at the beginning, some of you may work part time in retirement also, but there's a point where you're not going to be able to do that. Some of you may have an inheritance, and if you are, you're lucky.
So that's something to do. Financial plan recently reported this. So it would be prudent to like also have like a Roth in addition to the JRB fund.
Yeah. I mean, diversification is good. Did you say you were a financial planner before?
No.
You meant to be the financial plan. Okay. Great. Yeah, and we're happy to work with financial planners. Okay. First my primary goal is to make sure you have enough and cover your parsonage allowance. Now, you can take more from, you can save all through the JRB, just that anything above, the parsonage will be taxed. Okay? I mean, so it's better
but
to
why would it. Why wouldn't you just do it all through the, I mean, if you, why should you have to run after all your investments in different places if you just put it in one?
Good question. Well, remember, anything above the parsonage allowance will be taxed as what we call ordinary income, which is usually higher rates. If you have stocks or bonds and an after-tax investment like with Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley, those, when you redeem those shares, they're taxed as capital gains. And right now, capital gains is at a lower rate than income tax, okay? So that's one reason, you're paying less taxes. And you can do it both.
That's even in an IRA in retirement.
In an IRA in retirement, remember, that's the difference between us, the JRB, and an IRA. In an IRA, if it's a traditional IRA, all of the withdrawals will be taxed as ordinary income at the higher rates, even if it comes out of a stock. Okay? All distributions from pre-tax plans
The deal is that you just get to put that away from your income without it being
taxed up front.
That's the benefit.
Exactly.
But not on the back side.
Not on the back side. But the JRB, you get the benefit on the back side as well. Yeah. So you get the benefit on the front side, you get the benefit on the back side. Everybody with me?
Yeah.
Enough of this back side.
I'm just assuming that
beyond the parsonage expenses.
Yes.
That you take out of the retirement, this retirement plan,
right,
is taxed at a lower rate than it would have been had you...
Correct. That's the whole purpose. In other words, the ordinary income tax is based on your total income. Okay, the higher your in, we live in a progressive tax society, which means the higher your income, the higher your tax rate. Okay, when you're working, you're generally in a higher tax rate because or tax bracket because you're earning a salary. Retirement means for most of us, the largest source of our income is our salary. Okay, retirement means you're not earning a salary, so the largest part of your income is no longer there. Yes, you generally drop down to a lower tax bracket. Still, capital gains are lower because in the lower tax bracket as well. So you need both. My goal is to make sure you have enough for parsonage, you know, because to take advantage of all the tax benefits. But you do need both. So how much do you need? The experts tell us we need between 75 and 85%. We need to replace 75 to 85% of our gross income. Okay, so what does that mean? If you retire and your salary is $100,000, you need to replace that with about $75,000 to $85,000. I'll take an average of $80,000 each year in retirement to maintain the same lifestyle that you had prior to retirement. Okay, so that's all retirement is, replacing the income that you were earning before has to come from another source. I told you the three sources. It's Social Security, your savings in the JRB, your savings outside the JRB. So you need to accumulate enough so that you can generate, you know, say about 80% to replace 80% of your income. Everybody with me? Why don't you need 100?
Because the assumption is that the Social Security...
Exactly. Some expenses go away.
Personal savings is going to cover the rest.
Exactly. Certain expenses go away in retirement. What goes away? The self-employment tax. Remember, that's 15% right there. Number one. Number two, you don't have to save for retirement anymore. That's an expense when you're working. You're in retirement, okay?
You're not commuting to work anymore.
You're not commuting to work, right. Well, rabbis don't have a big commute. They just walk across the street, but no, I'm just kidding. But you're right. Yes, that's the idea. When I started doing this 30 years ago, we used to say, you didn't have to buy, you know, your clothing. You didn't have to buy suits anymore. Well, nobody wears suits anymore, but we had that.
Hopefully, supporting children.
Look, we used to say, hopefully you're not supporting college and the kids. Right. But that's no longer the case either, so we don't say that anymore. Still, you know, and if you have that, some financial planners say you need to replace 100%, okay? That just means you need to save more. How much do you need to save? Well, here's an example. Again, we gave this to a millennial. So here's my first rabbi who's 30 years old, you know, just got out of benefit, just graduated from the JTS or the Ziegler School within the last year. Salary is currently $75,000, has absolutely no savings in the JRB or in very little anyplace else. Okay? We are assuming that this person's going to have to retire at age 70. Okay, that's the good news and the bad news. The bad news is you get to work till 70, so the next 40 years. But the good news is you've got 70 years to generate enough, you know, savings to help you in the remainder. Remember, your life expectancy, you know, the IRS tells us your joint life expectancy with you and your spouse is to age 97. Okay? Even if you retire at 70, you're looking at spending 25 to 30 years in retirement. I'm not making these numbers up. Look at your congregations. I mean, how many, you know, congregants are in their 80s, 90s, and, you know, some even 100, okay? You're going to spend a long time in retirement, okay? And so you need to have enough money to, you know, the biggest risk is running out of money. So here's my projection, okay? I say that in 40 years, the person who's making $75,000 is going to make about $300,000. Now, don't think of $300,000 in today's dollars. It's tomorrow's dollars because all I use is an inflation rate of 3.5% a year. Okay, average increases of 3.5%. That's not, you know, that's not ridiculous. I don't think. Okay, so just the compounding alone means. What does it mean? It means essentially that $300,000 in 40 years from now is going to buy about what $75,000 to $100,000 buys today. That's all it means, okay? So don't think, I'm not going to make three. It's not $300,000 in today. It's $300,000 40 years in the future. And that's not unrealistic, I feel. So if you need to replace 80% of it, that's $236,000. If Social Security is here, as I said, It's worth $15,000, $20,000 today. In the future, that's worth $50,000. But remember, that only buys in the future, $50,000 only buys what $20,000 at most buys today. But I'm assuming it'll be there. If it's not, you got to save more. So you need to come up with enough money so that you can have at your disposal over $185,000 each year. Okay? You're going to hate me at the end of this. I forgot to preface. So. And so what do you need to retire if you're going to spend 25 years in retirement? You need to retire with at least, with approximately $3 million. Okay?
Now, what when you, the number two footnote, which assets are you speaking about that last until age 95?
Oh, your savings. This is 2.7 million.
That's the savings.
That's the savings, right. You need between...
Does it include selling your house?
Yeah, but then you got to buy a new house, and then we're going to pay rent.
Yeah, we're probably not going to need the same sort of house to live in.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, that's partial.
So you're saying the 2.7 isn't necessarily what you need to have in your JRB or your account. You're just saying that's what you need to live, and that may be able
well,
to.
If you put it this way, what's the present value? Meaning of a stream of payments of $186,000 for 25 years, what do you need at the first day? You need, $2.73 million. Okay. Now, yes, you'll have some money, and it'll be earning interest when it's not being used. You know, we've taken that all into account. So you need $3 million.
Does this take into account that you have a place to live or not? Let's say you own your house and you're going to stay there.
It takes into account that you're going to, the answer is generally yes. You have to live. So I'm taking that into account. Yes.
Does this take into account that by the time you're 70, chances are your parents might not be alive anymore and that you'll have inheritance also to get into there?
As I said, if you're, yes.
That's a big number I'm staring at.
Sure. My job is to scare you.
Take all that as a bonus.
Yeah.
Take it as a bonus. Don't expect it.
Just go into your, president's board and say, I need $2.7 million. That's all. But, that can be accumulated. Well, you'll see how we can accumulate that not so painfully. So if the accumulation goal is $2.7 million, and I've convinced you that you need about $2.73 million, I hope, how do you get there? Well, all you have to do is, for the next 40 years, contribute about $10,000 a year, okay, if you think that your earnings will average about 7%. So it's not so hard, okay? If you're worried about market performance or if you invest more conservatively, well, then you need to save almost twice as much, about $20,000 a year. Okay? And I always preface, you're going to take away two things, and this is one. You should aim to save 10 to 20% of your salary, your gross salary, including parsonage, including everything else in your contract, 10 to 20% each year that you're working. If you do that, you have a good chance. 10,000 to 20,000 is about 10 to 20% of a little over 20% for someone who makes $75,000. So it's not unattainable. Okay. So my job is to scare you. And we're also assuming that the $10,000 increases by about 2% each year. So in other words, you're putting in $10,000 in year one, $10,200 in year two, $10,200 plus 2%, which is another, about $10,400. So not me, 2% is you're following inflation, okay? You need more just to stand still. So we took a 40-year-old. So now we've got a 40-year-old rabbi whose salary is about $120,000. Their savings is $100,000 in the JRB. They're going to retire in 30 years. Again, the $100,000 today is going to be worth, when he retires or she retires, $336,000, which is 3.5% salary increases. You need to replace 80%, which is $268,000. Social Security is only going to be $40,000 because it's 10 years sooner than the other person. Okay, the 40-year-old will reach Social Security 10 years before the 30-year-old, and so that person's going to get less Social Security. And so you've got to replace $228 million, which means you need over $3 million. Same situation, but you have less time to accumulate it now. Oh, this is not fair. You're the expert.
So I'm not quite getting how at 40 you actually need more to live, because when you a 40-year-old who is going to hit retirement sooner, meaning that what things cost is going to be less than what it's going to cost when the 30-year-old reaches retirement. So, because they have, it's 10 years later when they reach retirement. So, why is it a higher? Why is it 336 that they're going to need to live, not the two?
The answer is it's approximately because number one, I'm saying you're starting with a high, you already have $100,000 to start with, okay, and over the next 30 years that's going to grow. The 30-year-old had zero savings. This person has $100,000, so I've taken into account that $100,000 is going to grow over 30 years, and that's going to mean that he has to save less going forward.
My question was more about the projected salary just before retirement, which doesn't seem to have anything to do with how much you put away. It has to do with how much you earn.
Right. I'm saying if you earn $120,000 today, at 3.5% increases each year for the next 30 years, that comes out to $336,000.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
I think that's, in this economy, 3.5%.
Again, yeah. Well, those are average. I mean, in this economy, you're right. I mean, if inflation starts kicking up, you know, people used to get 4%
raises. No, inflation is 3.5%. I don't think that synagogues or organizations are giving 3.5% increases.
So in that case, that's
what I've been flat for several years. I mean, I'm glad to have work, but part of the reality.
But maybe the idea is that when you come to your new contract at 5 years or 6 years, there's a possibility for not to be just a 3.5% or increase, but hopefully it's maybe a 8 or 10%
increase. Hopefully,
look, yes, you may need less. Okay, my goal is to scare you and give you a worst case scenario. If it's better for you, that's fine. Okay.
Is it 3.5% based on the CPI adjustment or based on average
inflation? Inflation is starting at 3%. Okay, I have charts and graphs that will show you. Okay. So, running late. Okay. To accumulate.
The other question is why a 30-year-old would need 2.7 million in retirement and a 40-year-old now would need 3.2 million? Like a 5.
Well, because.
More.
That
was your question?
Yeah. I don't understand. Those are.
This idea that they're making more.
Right. They're starting with a higher salary now. So.
But you're still going to assume that when they hit 40, that they're going to have the 120,000. Anyway, I don't know how important it is.
My job is to tell you you need a lot of money to save. But if your goal is to hit $3.2 million, you need to save about $16,500 a year if you think the market will do well. And if you think the market's going to do poorly, you need to put away $35,000 a year. How much can you put away? You know, these are the limits that the IRS sets each year. Salary reduction contributions are limited to $17,500. If your combined amount can be $52,000, and with a special catch-up, if you're over age 50, you can put another $5,500 in.
Do people do that?
Yeah. Hold that question. Oh, boy. That's a great question. Hold that question.
So what you're saying with that is that,
answer is yes.
Back to here, is that since you need, in the best case scenario, best market, 16,500, but yet you can really only do 17,500.
Well, you can do 52 if you're under 50. You can do 57,500 if you're over 50.
But that's at the employee and the employer.
Good question. So here's what I tell your colleagues. Because you negotiate your contracts, okay, if the congregation says we're going to pay you $100,000 and they're saying we're going to pay you $90,000 in cash and put $10,000 into the JRB, my answer is that $10,000 is considered an employer contribution, okay, because you've negotiated this with your salary, so we treat that as an employer contribution. If you go back to them and say, okay, pay me $75,000 and put $25,000 into the JRB, You're still being paid.
That comes into that second category.
Correct.
Employer. So,
employer.
So as long as they're putting the money in, and it's not you that's putting it in.
Exactly. You have that unique ability because you are negotiating your contract. Okay. If you work at IBM, you can't do that because IBM has a plan that covers everybody.
Right.
Okay. And so nobody can go to IBM's president and say, pay me more in my future retirement than you can pay me in my cash. You can't do that at IBM because they're under different rules. But you are negotiating your own contract, and they're structuring it the way you want it to be structured.
So is the difference between the employee salary reduction there is that you, even though you're having it taken off your paycheck before taxes, it's still coming into JRB through your name as opposed to your synagogue's name? Is that?
Yeah, it's coming in through the congregation. We get the check from the congregation. So in other words, what we're saying in my example is you can tell the congregation to pay you $75,000, put $25,000 into the JRB. That comes in as a salary, as an employer contribution. You think you may, you know, during later parts of the year, you think you needed an expense, but it didn't happen, so you can make your own salary reduction contributions of another $17,500. Okay? So you can play with the numbers. You get us $52,000. If you're under age 50, I'll figure out how to do it, and I'll help you figure out how to do it. If you're over 50, fine. Over age 50, you get us $57,500. I'll tell you how to do it if you can afford to do it. Okay,
right.
And you'll see that your colleagues are doing it.
Right. So I work in a nursing home, and I can only put in with the catch-up 23.5.
Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. And so, again, here's another reason if you're saving for retirement, it's preferable to do it through the JRB. Because, as I said, your contribution lowers your federal income tax, number one. If it comes as an employer contribution, it lowers your Social Security taxes. Okay? So, remember... okay, here's my example. So your compensation is $100,000. Your parsonage allowance is $30,000, and your contribution to the JRB is $20,000. Your reported income is $50,000. Everybody saving? Okay. 100 minus the 30 for parsonage minus the 20 for the retirement plan. Your self-employment taxes are the $100,000 minus the $20,000 that you contributed as an employer contribution. So you're lowering both your income tax and your Social Security tax. So in other words, you negotiate with your employer to pay you less in taxable income and more as an employer contribution. So it saves you income tax and it saves you Social Security tax. Okay, that's the advantage. Again, the goal, 10 to 20% a year in savings, and you're likely going to have a comfortable retirement. Okay, so what's the experience? How much have your colleagues saved? Okay, well, you know, look, we've got 141 rabbis between the ages of 70 and 79. The top 10% have saved, as of today, over $1.5 million. Okay? Same thing with those that are, you know, rabbis don't retire. You guys never retire.
That's total or with
that's in the JRB. That's just the JRB. I don't know what they have outside. That's what I know they have in the JRB.
That's individual, you mean each person has done a $1.5 million, or is that the total?
No, that's the top 10%.
So they're
okay?
Not eating your
so about in other words, 14 rabbis between the ages of 70 and 79, 10% of 141 is 14. Have over $1.5 million in the plan.
Total together
meaning
no.
As a fortune,
individually.
Right, and because of the current where we're at today,
yes.
that million and a half is fine to pay their what they need.
Exactly.
Even though we're looking at $3 million or whatever.
In 30 to 40 years from now.
Right,
exactly. That's the point we're trying to make.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So 90%
Well, another top quartile are 875. Okay, meaning the top 25% have more than this. Again, I only know what they have in the JRB. I don't know what they have outside the JRB. Okay.
Right.
The second quartile, which means the top 50% have over, you know, close to $500,000 in the JRB. Again, I said you needed to save both. Remember my three-legged stools. This is a JRB. I don't know what you, if you share that with us and we can, you know, do some projections for you, but even look over here. Look at your younger colleagues below 39. We have 145 of the plan. the top 10% have already accumulated over $155,000. Okay. So your colleagues are doing that. It's not impossible. Some of them are doing it. The first quartile, the top 25%, have more than $85,000. Okay. These are actual numbers as of December 31st of 2013. So compare yourself. See where you are on this chart, okay? And see where you want to be. And that's how you...
Being on the chart is better than being off the chart, right? Like, underneath the chart.
Yeah, well...
So if I actually fit into one of those quartiles...
Yes.
Then I have hope.
You have hope.
Okay. I don't need to be the top 10% or the first quartile. Right, I'm at least on there.
You're
there's
on
potential
there.
I can get there. Okay.
The other... There's two things you're going to take away from here. You're going to take away how much you need to save, and we're going to take away how to invest your money. And number three, you're going to take away that you should call me and schedule an individual appointment so we can review your situation. Because we have 1,100 rabbis, we have 1,100 different scenarios that we deal with. You've been quiet. Question?
I'm looking at the below 39 category, and that includes, I guess, in the third, the bottom one, rabbis that are just out of seminary. Right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's right. Hard. It's
first job.
Exactly.
Just opened up their
exactly.
Plan.
Right. It's a large category. Okay. It didn't make. There's so few under 30 that it wasn't worth putting it in. We've just done 10-year intervals. So,
okay.
Again, this is just, representative of what's in the plan. How much are people contributing? Okay, somebody asked me. Well, last year the limit was 56,500. It went up this year to 57,500. And so you've got rabbis that are over age 50 contributing the maximum, 56,500 down. Okay? So they're doing it. I'm telling you, these are rabbis that are doing it.
Okay? But you have a limit. You cannot... contribute about that limit.
That's the limit, 56,500 in 2013.
Not for everybody, is it?
It is, but again, you have to talk to me about your special situation.
So you have seven rabbis over 80, guys over 80 who are still contributing because they're working.
Exactly. You guys don't retire.
Yeah,
and they're still putting money in.
So you have seven guys who are paying you, who are contributing to retirement,
right.
$42,000.
No. I don't know how many of the seven are. The maximum of these seven, the person who put in the highest put in $42,000. I don't know if that's one, three, five, or seven.
That's
okay.
Story.
Okay. The first quartile, the top 25% of these seven, so that's about three.
Four of them are given five.
Has at least $33,000. Okay.
The most somebody. Okay. That's still pretty amazing.
These
guys are 80 are putting that much money in retirement.
Yeah.
And they're making money.
We have some very large balances on our account, I will tell you. We have $650 million. We have some very large accounts. We must have over 150 millionaires in the JRB plan, who have over a million.
And they're all, most of them are.
Yeah.
So I'm not one of those millionaires, but...
Not yet.
But
you will be.
In that prior slide, I was on a third quartile, and now in this slide, I'm on the first quartile.
Okay.
So I should...
Okay.
This is potential for me.
Exactly.
Okay.
But it means that you're putting away a good amount each year.
Exactly. Right? And you'll catch up, and you'll jump
quartiles. So I can catch up quicker.
You're going to catch up. The fact that you're even here shows that you're interested. Okay? So that puts you ahead of your colleagues. I call it, again, the clergy home run. The contribution lowers your taxable income. The earnings accumulate tax-free in the plan. When you invest outside the JRB in Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley each year, you pay tax on the growth, okay? You don't pay tax on the earnings in the JRB plan. The contributions lower your self-employment tax. If it's made as an employer contribution, which I've indicated you have that power to change, and you get the tax-free parsonage allowance withdrawals in retirement. Okay, this is the clergy home run for phenomenal purpose. It's great. Okay, we're going to shift gears a little bit because we're running out of time. We're going to do our best to finish up. We may not. Okay, so how to develop an investment strategy. So briefly, we're going to talk about investing your money, because before you do that, you have to understand what the elements are in developing an investment strategy. You have to know what type of investments are available to invest in. You have to know the historical performance of these investments. You have to be familiar with the risk debt investments involved, and then there are tools and techniques to manage risk, which we're hopefully going to have some time to go over. Ultimately, you're going to construct your own portfolio consistent with your investment goals and with your risk tolerance. So we don't give advice, but we do give guidance and education. And I don't know about you, but I've never found the line, but it's a fine line between the two, the advice and guidance. But we do our best. Okay, so raise your hand. Who wants maximum growth in your returns? Okay, who wants maximum safety? Doesn't want to lose anything. Raise your hands. Okay, so the classic dilemma of investing. We find that those investments which provide greater growth opportunities have less safety. Okay, so essentially, as an investor, each of us has to decide how much safety we are willing to sacrifice to get our investments to grow. That's it, in a nutshell. And what are the types of investments that cover that spectrum? Well, very conservative investments are here, on this side, on the left side. Okay, they offer protection and safety, but they don't offer much growth. Certainly, they don't offer growth to compensate for inflation. On the other side, the red, the hot red, okay, those are your equity investments, which offer more growth potential, but have greater investment risk, okay? So figure out where you want to be on that spectrum, okay?
Why is domestic equities a little safer
than international? All stocks are by definition are risky. They're all in the red zone. Okay. What we find is international stocks tend to be more risky than U.S. domestic stocks for three major reasons. Number one, political and economic uncertainty in other countries.
Okay?
You know, if you own money, you know, which Latin American dictator is going to take over the next corporation in, okay? Who is Putin going to take over in Russia, Ukraine, etc.? Okay, so you've got economic. Which of the next European countries is going to fall? It was Greece, it was Turkey. Okay, economic and political uncertainty overseas, number one. Number two, you've got currency fluctuations. So even if the company does well in its local currency, depending upon the strength or weakness of the currency compared to the U.S. dollar, when it's translated or converted into U.S. dollars, there's another risk factor, okay? And number three, I'm a CPA. I know that the ways of accounting for income and expense in the U.S. is governed by good rules. Those rules are not applied internationally. So a company may be telling me it's a good company and it's earning money, but I don't know if I can trust the accounting who's verified. Those three risks make international investing more. But again, we live in a global economy. Those are the bad sides. But you should own.
Does that exclude Israel bonds?
Well, I was talking about equities. Okay.
Bonds
are a little bit more safer, and here's the chart. So I told you that's the spectrum. These are the performance of the different types of investments that you can choose among. In a retirement plan, typically you have, as I said, stocks, bonds, treasury bills, which are essentially your cash or money market funds. And we compare that to inflation. So the question before was, you know, 3.5%. Well, inflation has averaged 3% over this period, okay, for the last 86 years. So inflation is our nemesis because it erodes the purchasing power of our dollars. And so we want to make sure that our investments are enough to cover inflation. What does inflation mean? You know, the gallon of gas that we pay $3.50 today is going to cost $25 a gallon in 30 years from now. That's just going to happen. You don't get more. You still get a gallon, but you're paying more. That's inflation. Okay, the price of eggs goes up. The price of butter goes up, etc., etc. That's what we have to beat. And it's incredibly difficult in retirement because at least when you're working, you're getting a salary. In retirement, you have nothing. So you have to have investments that grow to offset inflation. So let's say you're very risk-averse and you don't want to have your one complete safety and you want to invest your money in a treasury bill. That's a short-term debt instrument that's issued by the U.S. government, which matures in about 90 days to 100 days. I mean, 90 days to a year. You can't get safer than, you know, something offered by Uncle Sam. So So if you put a dollar in a treasury bill in 1926, that dollar grew to $21, 87 years later.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That was safety. Okay, that was your ultimate safety, but you're really beating inflation. The orange line represents the bonds, okay? Bonds are complicated investment vehicles, but let's just say they tend to be less risky than stocks. Bonds are loans, okay? When you buy a $100,000 treasury security today, what you're doing is you're loaning Uncle Sam $100,000, okay? If you buy the 10-year bill, it's paying about, what, 2.5%, 2.7%? That means you'll collect $2,500 in interest income for 10 years, and 10 years from now, Uncle Sam's going to write you a check for $100,000 and say, thank you very much for loaning me your money.
And now you have Israel bonds available, so you can say,
same with Israel.
I want to support Israel and their economy by doing that. I know that my money will be fairly secure because it's a fairly safe kind of thing, but I also am not going to expect very much return on it.
It's safe, exactly. Bonds, by interest rates in general, are low. But right now, if you put a dollar in a U.S. government bond in 1925 or 26, that dollar grew to about $109. So better than you got in the money market, clearly, and you still beat inflation. With less risk, more straight line, okay? For an average return of about 5.5% over the last 87 years, okay? So then we look at stocks. Those are the other investments that are generally available in the plan. And all stocks, as I said before, as you show sort of the red in the spectrum, we're in the red. We generally divide the stocks domestically by the size of the company in which the fund invests. We call them large company funds and small company funds. Large company funds invest in the large companies like American Express and General Electric and Microsoft, et cetera, et cetera. All the companies that you read about in the papers every day. These are 500 of some of the largest companies in the U.S., and they're so large that they dominate the stock market to the tune of about 75%. So they capture the returns of 75% of the stock market.
That's
the S&P? S&P 500, correct. If you put a dollar in an S&P 500 fund in 1926, that dollar grew to about $4,600, over $4,600. 86 years later. So we're seeing, again, much greater growth in stocks compared to bonds and treasury bills.
A dollar in 1926 would be worth how much now? just
$13. Okay.
But then if you're looking at, I guess, 1990 for those large stocks, the difference between 1990 and now, there's not that much increase because we went down and enough time to give the fluctuation.
Okay, good point. I'll get to that. You'll see. Okay. The small company stocks. The small company stocks are represented by the darker blue line. Small companies are companies in which you've never heard of. Okay. But 15 years ago, there was a small company called Google that nobody ever heard of 15 years ago. And if you were fortunate enough or lucky enough to invest in Google 15 years ago, you wouldn't be here today. Okay, you'd be circling your yacht in the Caribbean. Okay, circling.
You'd have your own shul on that yacht too.
What's that?
You'd have your own shul on that.
You'd have that own shul on that lot, and even if you were the only congregant, you could do it. Okay.
We'd buy 9 others.
So small company stocks offer tremendous growth. A dollar invested in 1926 grew to over $26,000 in 1987. Dramatically higher than any of the other investments. But I'll ask you another question. There were hundreds of companies that started the same time as Google did. And you don't know who they are. And they're out of business. Okay? So they're riskier. Small company funds are generally riskier because you're relying on a company that's small that may make it, that may not make it. Okay, you're taking on additional risk. Whoops, we're getting a little bit late. Is this helpful? So here's a way to control risk. Time is the best tool available for controlling risk. And it's very important for retirement because, again, ask yourself how much time between now and when you expect to retire, which could be 65, 70, or you have rabbis who are working in their 80s. And then you have to understand that your time horizon is going to add another 20 to 30 years, okay, in retirement. So that's a long time. Understand what's the alternative to being in retirement? It's not working.
It's death.
Okay, yes. So you want to stay a long time in retirement, okay? So three scenarios. We looked at the stock market, and these are Morningstar charts. I don't know if anybody heard of Morningstar, the major mutual fund research company. They looked at the returns in the stock market over the last 86 years and found that about 70%, 75% of the years the market's up, and about 30% of the years the market's down. We're not saying how much it's up or how much it's down. Just on a year-by-year basis over the last 76 years, last 86 years. Then we looked at five-year intervals, meaning 1926 to 1931, 1927 to 1932. Everybody with me? Those mm-hmm. overlapping five-year intervals, and what we find is about 86% of the time, the market is up. Okay, so that's a way to control risk. In other words, there's an 86% probability that if you hold your stocks for 5 years, even if they take a dip, they're likely to recover. 86%
within the 5 years.
Within the 5 years, okay? And look, we again, we have the most recent experience to look at that. In October of 2007, the Dow is a reflection of stock market activity. It was at 14,000. Okay, a year and a half later, in March of 2009, the Dow was under 7,000. So everybody who had money in stocks, to go from 14,000 to under 7,000, that's a 50% decline. All of your stock holdings declined in value by about half, and you all panicked, okay? And today, the stock market is 5 years later, is over 16,000. So we've not only come back to 14, we've gone higher, okay? That's the most recent. Now, it's not going to happen all the time. I'm just saying that's recent. So don't look at your statements and panic. Look at time. The third example is 15 years, meaning 1926 to 1941, 1927 to 1942. Every 15-year period over the last 86 years have experienced positive returns in the stock market. That's why stocks are good investment vehicles for long-term goals, because they have the potential. Okay, I'll go back to my previous slide. You're going to go through a rocky ride, okay, and you're going to panic when it's down here, and it's down here, and it's down here, okay? But don't look at it on a daily basis. If you want that safety and you don't want the ups and downs, simple. Put your money in the green line, the money market fund. But you're going to have a greater risk of running out of money in retirement because it doesn't keep pace with inflation. On the other hand, look at how many 15-year intervals you have before you retire.
If you don't.
I'm going to move on a little. So how can you, what's appropriate to you? Well, again, as a general rule, we can't give investment advice. We're providing guidance and education. These model portfolios are considered educational by the Department of Labor, which is the U.S. government agency which regulates pension plans, okay? So we've divided these models based on a person's age and risk profile, okay? So if you're a millennial between the ages of 20 and 40, if you held 85% of your money in the red area, that's stocks, that would be considered aggressive and appropriate. Why? Because if you're, 35 years old, you're not retiring for at least 30 years, okay? You've got that 30, you've got a couple of 15-year intervals if you've got 35 years. So putting your money in stocks at a high level when you're young is very prudent. For the goal of retirement, if your goal is to buy a house in 5 years, stocks are inappropriate, okay? Because in 5 years, it may come back. It did the last time, but there's only 86% probability. The other 14, 15% may take 10 years or 20 years. I don't know. If I knew, I would tell you. But if I knew that, I would be on that. Yeah.
But you're saying that it's prudent to do that, but yet that is only fitting one particular kind of personality model, which is aggressive, because...
It's not a personality, it's an investor. I've seen the most.
Quiet
mouses have 100% of their money in stocks.
No. So what you're saying, though, is that for somebody 21 to 40, you feel like an aggressive strategy, something, in a sense, you say it's high risk.
Right.
But because you have time, is it really high risk?
Exactly.
And you're saying no. It's not.
I'm saying no because it's high risk on a day-to-day basis. You're going to see fluctuation. If you let it grow over 30 years, the answer is no. But of course, you're 30 years away. You know, even if you know a moderately aggressive investor in this age group, as you get older, between 40 and 55, you want to start reducing the money in stocks. You're closer to your goal. You have less time to recover in a down market. Again, we reduced it at age 55 to 65, but even in retirement, you know, at 65, I'm telling you, you're going to spend 20 to 30 years in retirement, so you need to have a nice portion of your money in stocks.
You're using that moderately aggressive, but that, yeah. But in a sense, when you go to 56 and 65, what I'm hearing you say is that the aggressive model, 60%, mm-hmm. is still prudent.
All of these are prudent, okay? They are investor profiles. Some people like chocolate, some people like vanilla. One is not more prudent than the other.
But one is going to have higher, one is going to give you more dollars.
Potentially. Yeah. Potentially. This is not guaranteed. Right. Potential. If you're willing
to... You're just talking probabilities.
Exactly. If I can predict the market, I would tell you. But if I could, I wouldn't be here. Yes.
Mitch, generally, when I think of equity, I think buying individual stocks. Mm-hmm. Do you think you're a little bit more protected in terms
of...
Because most of the funds that we have may be equity funds.
They are.
But stocks are going to be more volatile than others. But I don't think you have the same exposure.
Individual securities, buying individual stocks are much more risky than buying mutual funds.
And what are the, does this represent funds or individual stocks?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, you know, equities are equities, okay? Individuals going to be more, I'm not talking about large cap stock equities or small cap stock equities or international equities or individual equities or mutual funds. I'm talking about all stocks, okay, as a general category.
But with the JRB, aren't you?
Ours are mutual funds.
Right, so all of these are just
mutual funds. Right. But these models should reflect all of your savings, okay? You know, if you want to be aggressive in the JRB and more conservative outside of the JRB, is, you know, pick a model that should be. Another rule of thumb, I'm sure you use this, the rule of thumb is subtract your age from 100, okay? And that's the amount of money that you can comfortably have in stocks. And if you want to be more aggressive, you can go up to another 15%. So what's an example? If you're 40 years old, 100 from 40 is 60%. So 60% for a 40-year-old in stocks, oops. I went to 40. Sorry. So 60%, okay, in stocks for a 40-year-old is considered appropriate. Add another 15%, you're at 75. Okay. So that use that as a, it's not a law, it's a guide, it's a rule of thumb. Subtract your age from 100, and within add 15 up to 15%, and that's what's considered a prudent risk portfolio.
I have one main question is. What if you reach the age of retirement?
Yes.
And that year you have in 2008.
Yes.
And you start taking out money.
Right.
Therefore, even if it recuperates, you still can make money because you're taking out.
That's a great question. And so when you work with me, you have this room now?
No.
Okay. Oh, you want to come in? Okay. Sure. We're running a little bit late, but anybody, if you have to leave, don't worry, I'm not going to be insulted. We're just going to take your name and take money out of your account. I understand. It's going, you're welcome to stay. I can stay. It's up to you. Some of you have to catch a train. Well, I've got a couple more slides and then I'm set. Okay? The key here is to have a well-diversified portfolio. Okay. To answer your question, when you're in retirement, you only want to keep about 35-40% of your account in stocks. Okay, so when the market went down by 50%, only a portion of your portfolio was affected. So in that time, at that stage, what I would say is when you start to take your money out, don't take it out of the stocks, because by selling your stocks, you're selling it at a loss at that time. That's why you want to have a reserve in the bonds and the cash. So if you need $50,000, you take that out of the conservative investment when you're 65 or 70 and you need the money if the market is down. Okay? If the market is up, then you want to take the money out of the stocks to lock in the gain. That's what we call diversification, having, you know, multiple asset classes. All right, a few last slides, and then we'll call it, and if anybody has questions, I'm happy to stay. So what determines investment success? Studies have been done, you must use this slide all the time, over 90%, she does the same thing I do, so we're going to hire her. Over 90% of the stocks, 90% of your investment success is based on your asset class. What's asset class? This. Okay, how you divide your money between stocks, bonds, and cash. Okay, everybody says it's not a good time to be in the stock market. Okay, timing accounts for about 2% of your expected return success. Somebody says, well, this is a good manager, that's a bad manager, boom, boom, boom. That accounts for about 3% of your success. The other 3% is just muscle. So focus on your asset class that's appropriate for you, whether you're conservative, moderately aggressive, or aggressive. There's no right or wrong here, okay? You are what you are as an investor. As I said, they make chocolate, vanilla, they make pistachio, they make every flavor in the rainbow, because people have different risk profiles. And people have different circumstances also. But choose your investment strategy, give it a chance to hold. What are these, look at these time frames. We're talking about 20 years here, we're talking about 15 years here, we're talking about 10 years here, and over 65, it could be another 20 to 30 years. So don't panic, okay? Let your strategy work for you. I'm going to have to end it.
Can I have a question about the next slide?
Which?
This one.
This one?
No, the one after that.
This one?
Yes.
Okay. So that's what's available in the JRB.
So with the JRB, can you do things like for instance, there's some portion of your mutual funds that are bonds.
Correct.
So can some of those be Israel bonds? Can you do a mix and match, or are they all
full package? No.
You can set up.
Israel bonds are a little bit more, again, risky, because it's one company, one country, excuse me.
No, I understand, but I guess, you know, all
of these. If you want to put Israel bonds into your percentage of the... Over here, yes, but in the green portion, that's fine.
And can you do mix match of socially responsible?
Sure.
So you can you can work with us to put up our whatever our nomination.
Exactly. That's my job.
Okay.
I'm happy. Beautiful. Please call me. We don't charge you to do
this. I will be calling.
Okay. Wait. You have to see this one last slide. Why do we know that diversification is the way to be? It says so in Baba Metzia. Okay. There's our justification. For diversification, let every man divide, and of course, old women, divide your money among three equal parts. A best of third in land, that's real estate, your home that you own. A third in business, that's stock, okay? And a third in reserve, that's your cash and your bonds. So don't listen to me, okay? It's right there in Baba Metzia. Okay, take away two things. Save 10 to 20% of your salary, diversify your portfolio. I'll take questions.
Do you want to say anything about the Parsonage case?
Okay, that's my appendix. The Parsonage case, I'm happy to do it. You don't have to stay, you can go. I'm not going to be insulted.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah, okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Before you go on to Parsonage.
Yeah, sure.
And so what if, maybe I should talk to you about this privately. I am currently on disability.
Okay.
And not making. I have retired. Like I have a disability money I'm receiving, but I'm not currently earning anything.
We have to talk privately.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah. Great. That's a unique situation.
Yeah.
So it's good, good point. Okay. Yeah. But we still have to save for retirement. But we'll,
yes,
we'll
I do.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
I'm sorry. But yeah, those are individual.
But we have the added like. I need to figure out what I need to save to help me medically later on when it's really bad.
Yeah. You know, everybody has, as I said, we have 1,100 rabbis, we have 1,100 different situations. Okay?
Well,
but we're here.
Plenty of rabbis have my situation.
We have some rabbis in that situation. Yeah, I mean, we don't publicize it. Okay, the Parsonage case, my little appendix. Okay, not much to say. You know most of it already. I don't have anything to update. I mean, it was the district court in western Wisconsin which held that the first Parsonage allowance was unconstitutional. That was just that was our pre-Thanksgiving dinner, you know, joy. Okay, a week before Thanksgiving, that's when the court decided this. So we all, you know, had lousy Thanksgivings, okay, if you knew about it. As I said, the ruling only applies to the housing allowance. In other words, if you live in a home that's owned by a congregation or the church, quote unquote, you're not affected. Okay, this only affects the cash allowance that's paid to you to own or rent your own home. That's all that's affected. The ruling originally was what we call stayed, meaning it wasn't implemented pending the appeals process. We all waited I mentioned I'm on the Church Benefits Association. I sit on the board. I gather with my colleagues who administer the pension plans for the other denominations, the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, etc. There are 50 of us, okay? They're like six church of gods, which I don't understand the difference. But anyway, there are American Baptists, there are Southern Baptists, there are two or three Lutherans, there's the Missouri Synod Lutherans, there's the Evangelical Lutherans.
Conservative.
Right, exactly. I just feel like we all should get up and tell, forget the vote, let's just tell what our denomination stands for. And you're right, we have Reform, Orthodox. They have no idea what the Reform is, or they're conservative, but the Reform and I are actively involved. So that's that we were involved with, and we all waited with bated breath to see whether there would be an appeal. And the government had 60 days in which to appeal, and on the 59th day, they filed their appeal. Okay? So we were all... Now, part of that was the longer you delay in making the appeal, the more time you have to prepare the appeal. So we were hoping that that was the case. And lo and behold, yes, in January, the appeal was filed. Again, the first bullet is the case summary. There is this organization in Wisconsin called the Freedom from Religion Foundation, and they are atheists, and they sue the IRS commissioner and the Treasury seeking that the Minister of Housing Allowance violates the Establishment Clause.
They're all Jews. Most of them are Jews.
Oh,
God, it's embarrassing.
Really?
Yeah. All their spokesmen on the news channels have Feldman, Cohen.
They took a very creative approach to this, and that's a good understanding because that's one of the issues. What they did, okay, what the Freedom, it's a not-for-profit organization domiciled in Wisconsin, Western Wisconsin. What they did was grant a parsonage allowance to their executive director and their chief financial officer, okay? Which has nothing to do. They're not ministers. They're not ordained. Okay, and so they sued the IRS for taking this declaration and thinking it would be disallowed. Okay, and the IRS came back and said, well, you know, you haven't really followed through. We haven't made a decision. Well, that's fine. You call me. We haven't made a decision on whether we're going to allow you to, whether we're going to deny your parsonage declaration. And the IRS said, well, we may think that atheists are ministers in their own right, that the advocation for no religion is itself an organized form of religion. And so they may grant them parsonage, but they never got there, okay, because they brought it to court, and the judge said, hey, IRS, don't pull the wool over my eyes, okay? We know you're going to declare it. We know you're going to deny it eventually. So let's just cut the crap and excuse the French. And let's not waste another year and a half going through this process. Let's just take on the case now. We have there's a very activist judge. So that's how the case came to be. The notice of appeal, as I said, was filed on the 59th day in January. At that point, the clock starts to tick as to when the government has to file its brief to contest the court case. That brief was due on April 3rd. And so the government filed this brief on the last day. And the government's brief, again, says the Freedom from Religion Foundation does not have standing, meaning that they were not harmed. Nobody in that organization was harmed yet, okay, because the IRS hasn't declared they're taking a parsonage allowance. They haven't denied they're taking the parsonage allowance. So you can't just sue because you don't like policy. You have to be harmed in order to have a lawsuit. And so the IRS's position is that the Freedom From Religion Foundation did not have a loss, did not have a damage, and therefore has no right to sue. So that's the major emphasis of the case of the government. However, the government goes on to say, if you find, you being the judge, find that they do have standing, they've gone on to say that there are other professions which enjoy a housing allowance, and it's not just clergy. Okay? That's the crux of their case. Military personnel who are actively in service either live on a base for free, or if there's no room on the base, they live in a house. Again, they get the housing allowance if you're an active military employee. College presidents also. College presidents live for free. Most people didn't know that. Okay? So that's another profession or category. Individuals who work overseas. If you work overseas, either for the Foreign Service or if you're an IBM employee based in France, there is a special rule, we call it 9/11 income, there a certain percentage of your salary is tax-free, okay, as an accommodation for your living abroad, which mostly goes to your housing. Okay, so the key here is that clergy are not the only ones who get the housing allowance. And in fact, there is a special provision of the tax code that says that the employer can provide this tax benefit to their employees for the accommodation of the employer. And so our case, the government's case, is that churches and congregations are providing this allowance as an accommodation of their employee. Okay, so that's the case that they're trying to make. In addition, as I said, I'm on the board of the Church Benefits Association. We also have a separate lobbying group called the Church Alliance, made up of the 35 CEOs of the pension boards, of which I'm one. And so we submitted a week later an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court. Amicus means friend. Okay, so we submitted a friend of the court brief, and our position, we hired attorneys, in Chicago, where the appeals process is being done. And our position is, hey, look, we live in a Judeo-Christian society. Religion has enjoyed a privilege in our tax laws for 200 years. Okay? So, you know, and there's precedence, and, you know, we're saying that the parsonage allowance is just part of this accommodation to religion. It's not establishing a religion, it's an accommodation to religion. So that's our position. For the friend of the court brief, the government's position is twofold, that there's no standing, and if there is standing, that other professions enjoy parsonage. So that's what we're hoping. What's the outcome? You know, I don't know.
How soon might it, or how long?
We assume if they hear oral arguments, the oral arguments will be in June. Mm-hmm. And if they hear oral arguments, then it will be a couple more months before they make a decision. So
there a possibility which is going
on? Boy, if I could predict that, it's like predicting the stock market.
I don't know if it would help your case, but when I was in the military, even when you did your two-week duty, even then you were living on base or whatever it was, you still got your housing allowance.
Right.
Paying for your home wherever you happen to live, which could, you know, which is actually more liberal than the position where clergy can't even have a vacation home.
Right.
That's an interesting point.
Okay. We have included that. If you look, the governor brief is very detailed. It covers every case, every situation that's occurred where it's been found favorably.
Thank you.
Okay, I hope this is helpful. You know, we've had conversations.
Hey, are you going back to the room? Or no?
Somebody mentioned yesterday now that you can take the parsonage allowance on a second home.
No, there was a court case that was set also in Wisconsin. No, in Ohio. The answer is no. Here's what happened. You'll like this.
We'll be in touch with
you. Okay. You have another unique situation, so I know because you're a chaplaincy, so call.
Okay. Yeah.
Bring your wife, and we'll talk. So here's that case. What that case was, There was a minister in, I forget which church, and he had a country house about an hour away, and he claimed that he spent his time ministering in the actual church, but he wrote his sermons at his country home, and therefore wanted to take a parsonage on two homes. And the tax court said yes, under the following scenario, that he could do this, because there is a section of the tax law that says singular means plural, and plural means singular. So if the tax code says a minister can take on his home, that the tax court said, well, home is plural, so he can take it on two homes. Okay, the IRS contested and said, well, maybe the minister has 7, 8, 9, 10. How many homes is can he?
Mitt Romney didn't even know how many he had.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the IRS appealed and the IRS won. So still one part. It's your primary risk.
Yeah, so whoever
one carry, one grab, always saying, oh no, I have two, my account told me I could take two.
No, I don't think so.
I heard that, I was like, no.
Tell them to call me.
We'd love to do that.
Tell them to call me, for about a month, it was in this one area of the country in Ohio. So if you were a minister, so maybe for 1 month in Ohio, you could have claimed a parsonage on two residences during that period of time.
You know, I do remember reading about the one minister who apparently was doing well, and it flagged them because they said he was taking an excessive amount of $75,000. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, if you live in San Francisco, I would imagine you are. I have a $54,000 parsonage, and it just covers what I'm spending.
We have rabbis and some cantors that claim $85,000 parsonage. But they live in L.A., they live in San Francisco, they live in, New York or expensive parts of
whatever city they're in.
Connecticut. Yes.
So I don't think 54 should be a flag now.
I always say, cover yourself. This is a tax. Parsonage is a tax declaration. So just as you the IRS, if you're audited and you say, I made an $18 contribution to the UJA, they have every right to say, show me your credit card receipt or cancel check for your $18 contribution. And if you can't supply it, they say, we're taking it off, you owe tax on that money. Same thing with parsonage. Right. There is a rule of how parsonage is determined. So they want to see your receipts for your mortgage payments, your property taxes, utilities, your homeowner's insurance, etc. They want to see that, and then they want a substantiation as to how you determined the fair market rental value of your furnished home. So I always tell your colleagues, have something in writing from a real estate broker. Real estate brokers, agents, they have the best pulse on real estate in the area.
Right.
Tell them, you're thinking of moving to Israel for a year, and part of that decision is that I want to rent out my home, and obviously renting it out furnished is going to be at a higher level than unfurnished, because the tenants won't have to buy the dining room set, the kitchen set.
And I assume to that you could also add utilities and stuff.
Plus the utilities to that number.
You don't have to count exactly. Because, I do, when
plus
we get a roof repair,
yes,
or a roof change, you split that over different years.
Exactly. That's what I tell your company. You're a roof change.